really a fun record. We heard the song Boiling Point from that. That was coming out of Savage Republic, Andalusia, from Procession, An Oral History, 1981 to 2010. And you know, the first and only time I went to CBGB's, which was long after anything good was really happening there in the early aughts, a friend was in town, she wanted to go see CBGB's, and the Penetrators were playing, so I was like, all right. We went, we hung out, and Ethan Port from Savage Republic stopped by and said hi, and he was a real friendly guy. Hi, Ethan. Chris Forsythe and the Solar Motel Band with Solar Motel Part 2 from a live release on LP, and Psychic Frost at the top of the set with Psychic Airlines. Wow, we are totally running out of time here. It's Leesburg on WFMU. My show's ending at 11 a.m. because Benjamin Walker is coming in with a surveillance special, and that starts at 11. Again, his special guest is Susan McGregor of Columbia University's Tao Center for Digital Journalism, and they're going to be talking about hidden sensors, third-party cookies, and other tracking technology, and they're going to be having a video feed of their broadcast. They're going to be showing all kinds of crazy surveillance stuff. You can watch the video at WFMU.org or on the WFMU app on your smartphone. All right, I don't have much time, but let's play another song or two, right? Here's something new from Mr. Scruff. Yeah.
You are listening to WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, and in Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. My name is Benjamin Walker. It's about 11:02 here in the studio, and thanks to Liz Berg, we are doing a special hour for the next hour using WFMU's new video streaming capabilities that you can find if you go to the WFMU homepage. I think we should be playing this live. WFMU's built some pretty amazing features into the new app, and you should be able to watch it on the phone as well. And a few months ago, we were discussing this, and I said, you know, we should do like a special on surveillance. And then, now it's time to do that special on surveillance. And yours truly has come back to visit the station today. Thanks to Liz Berg for making room for this. But I'm very, very excited because joining us in the studio today is Susan McGregor, who is the assistant director of the Tau Center at the Columbia Journalism School. Hey, Susan, say hello.
Hello.
That's great. So I've got to hear Susan speak a few times now, and if there was one person I'd want to talk to about surveillance for an hour, it would be her. So I want to thank you very much for coming on down.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's just plunge into this, because an hour is going to be fast. We have the comments going on the AccuPlaylist page. Liz just switched over, so we even remembered the password for the old Too Much Information show. And we have a show AccuPlaylist going. And if you are watching the stream, you're going to be see some of the images that some listeners have sent in, images of sensors and camera feeds that they've been documenting or wondering about. And we're going to talk about those. But it's not just about video surveillance. We're going to be talking about metadata, all kinds of biometric surveillance, and hopefully go with what we can do about it. But first, let's just, if you could introduce yourself a bit, Susan, and talk about what you do and how surveillance has become a bigger part of what you do.
Sure, thanks. I am wrapping up my third year at Columbia Journalism School. And before I was at Columbia, I was at the Wall Street Journal, and I worked on a series there called What They Know. And What They Know is sort of an exploration of what kind of data was being collected by websites about visitors and users. We did a lot of work on tracking cookies and all of that. And when I went to Columbia, we started, you know, this idea was already sort of percolating, and I came into contact with some colleagues in the computer science department. I have some background in computer science as well. And talking about one of my colleagues in particular had done her dissertation work on the idea of vanishing data. And so if you have something of a technical background, you know that things don't really disappear in computers. When we delete things or remove something to the trash, it isn't really gone. And so I thought this was a really fascinating idea. And at the same time, it was becoming clear actually sort of how possible it was for data to be collected online sort of massively in ways that actually up until that time I hadn't really realized possible. I had sort of thought there's so much data going over the internet, you couldn't possibly catch it all. And I discovered sort of at the end of that year that I was wrong and you can catch it all.
Were these the revelations that we all...
No, this was actually a couple of years before, but I had heard a couple of folks speak on the subject and realized that... That was the case. Actually, Laura Poitras and Jake Applebaum were speaking at the Whitney, and this would be the spring of 2011, and along with Bill Binney, and sort of saying, look, this is possible. And it was something that I really didn't appreciate until then. And following that, understanding sort of what the implications were for journalists, as I'm a journalist and work with many of them, began exploring, along with some colleagues, ways to create communication apps that would help protect journalist communications. And so it's all kind of snowballed from there. I was doing that work at the end of last year, and then of course we had the Snowden revelations. Right. And since then it's something that's really obviously become a mainstream topic to discuss. And it's, you know, so really important.
So Poitras ends up blowing your mind first. Mm. in 2011, and then participates, obviously, with Glenn Greenwald in blowing all of our minds.
Absolutely.
Which is, I guess, is coming up about a year ago now. Yeah. I don't know if you saw the Frontline PBS special that's airing right now on surveillance. It's a two-part one. They ran part one last week, and part two will be tomorrow. But there are what really blows my mind about the surveillance story is that you think it can't, that you can't possibly learn anymore, and like every few weeks there's another bombshell that comes out, and it was really fascinating to watch. I really recommend checking out the Frontline special, and I think some of the things on part two are what we're going to be talking about this hour, about sort of commercial enterprises and other kinds of surveillance besides video government surveillance. But for me, one of the most amazing revelations in the hour was they had Bill Keller and James Risen, the reporter, the defense or technology surveillance reporter, talking about how they were going to break the metadata collection story in 2004, right before the election, and Bush convinced Bill Keller not to spike the story, not to run the story.
Yeah.
And James Risen is on camera talking about it, how it was a kind of a game of chicken in 2005 when he was going to publish the story in a book. And Bill Keller on camera admits that that the only reason they published it was because Risen was going to go public and it would have made them look bad.
Yeah.
But, and then, you know, I was really excited for the everyone to talk about it, and then the Jill Abramson story happened the next day. But besides, you know, thinking back to that moment in 2011, what has sort of surprised you? What do you feel are some of the things that we should be really paying attention to and changing how we talk about surveillance that have happened over the last year, sort of post-Snowden?
Well, I think some of the biggest things are I think the biggest area for everyone to be thinking about is email, actually, and what is accessible, what can be surveilled via email. Basically, the way the law is written right now, if an email is opened or more than 180 days old, it's essentially fair game. It doesn't require a warrant for law enforcement to look at it. The reality of a situation, I think, runs counter to most people's expectations because we call it email, and so we expect it to be like an electronic version of mail, and it's really not. And so I think, I think it's also important that folks realize that we're at a really, with surveillance, with net neutrality, we're at a really important policy moment right now. So I think it's not, I think the other thing to realize is that it's not just about technology and it's not just about encryption and it's not about solely about the digital stuff. It's really about, sort of old fashioned political action at this point and really kind of getting active around these subjects as a matter of policy. Because, frankly, until the laws change, this is always going to be possible. It's the way the systems are designed, and they're designed that way of necessity. So we really have to get together on the legislative side and really change how these things are allowed to be legally handled. Because that was the thing when the Snowden stuff broke last year. That sort of surprised me was not what I expected. Was when Pelosi and these folks come out and say, "Yeah, of course. What are you talking about? We've been doing this for 7 years. We've been collecting this metadata for ages." Just totally unfazed. Even as the public was really quite shocked. So,
although I would argue that what along with that there was a large public reaction that also was not shocked or fazed. It seemed like you hear a lot of like, "Well, I don't have anything to hide. That this might not be. So what?" Such a bad thing. I mean, would you say that was something you noticed as being a prevalent response as well?
Yeah, I think there's naturally a tendency to think, there must be a good reason for this. I think especially given the sort of I think given that there wasn't sort of this scramble on the political side to say, oh my gosh, what's happening, but just sort of, yeah, of course, we're doing this. I think we've become very conditioned to think, we're in a war on terror, and so all, this all needs to happen. And obviously, the sort of I have nothing to hide argument comes up, or, statement comes up a lot. But I think one thing that I think is important is to realize that it's not just you. It's also like your children is a really important thing to realize. These things are happening to everyone. And unless you're sure that your kids are not on the internet, then theoretically there are laws around that. But I think we know that those don't always hold up the same way. And also, and really what we're talking about is kind of the idea of personal, is the idea of identity and personal integrity, right? The ability to be who you want to be and sort of an independence. And it's not about, what's often said is it's not about having something to hide. It's, do you have something to protect or someone to protect? And I think that's really the sort of thing, the thing to consider. This is about the ability to be who you are. And as one friend of mine mentioned, sometimes that means the ability to ask questions. One of the really important things that we can do on the internet is be able to ask questions that we couldn't ask in another sphere, and we can't necessarily always ask as ourselves, right? So there's a really important component of the freedom to explore and to learn and access information. And that's not something that one can do freely if you feel you're being watched all the time.
Absolutely. So if you're just tuning in, you're listening to a one-hour special here on surveillance. My name is Benjamin Walker. We're squatting on Liz's show. Susan McGregor from the Tau Center for Journalism at Columbia is here. And talking about that, sort of reframing how we're talking about surveillance. And can you talk a little bit about this white paper that you're working on there? Because I feel it's for journalists, but what you just referenced about, being able to function in a society without being watched kind of goes beyond just the scope of journalists.
Yeah, I mean, the white paper is coming out in a little less than a month now, and it is sort of an overview of the legal and technical reality that we're operating in. And it is actually all of us. So the interesting one of the interesting things is that there's actually nothing in this or there's very little in it that specifically pertains to journalists. So it's, if you're talking about email communications, telephone communications, it's actually everybody, right? There's not special systems that journalists are using, or there isn't a special access because they're journalists. And so, the idea is to really take a detailed look at, how the law sees the privacy or lack thereof around our various types of digital communications, understanding how the systems work, exactly what is exposed and when we send an email or make a telephone call, and then also, strategies for sort of responding to that. So, tools and approaches that you can use if you do need to be able to do that thing, like ask a question without being tracked for it.
Yeah. So we've gathered a few things to play over the air and show on the video stream. But I kind of want to go back to video, because I think that one of the things both Susan and I have been talking about is, I think 1984 was such a meme since Snowden, Snowden even said in his Christmas address, it's worse than 1984. And you kept really hearing that. And I felt that one of the big arguments of 1984 is that, the cameras will always be, they're two-way, they'll always be spying on us. And if there was an academic in 1984 that Neil Postman, who came out with a book that year that's Amusing Ourselves to Death, who sort of, was really one of the first people who pushed back against that idea and said, no, the real issue is that we're giving away our own freedoms. We're the ones choosing to, interact with these screens, and especially talking about the television. And I feel that, today, that argument is kind of, you could kind of say that doesn't work anymore, because the screens that we interact with today are just embedded in part of our lives, and we could not do that. But having just made a piece myself on 1984, I was realizing how many of the same arguments we're having today we were actually having in the year 1984.
Yeah.
And I have a little clip about, this was on 2020, about video that I feel sort of, I want to just play a minute of here. And you can watch it on the screen too.
This is the subject of John's report tonight, the home videotape recorder, and I hear that it's the biggest craze since the hula hoop.
They're selling unbelievably well. Even the manufacturers are selling more than they ever expected to. They think maybe 7 million this year. Some people buy several.
In the suburbs of New York, Steve Lincoln lives in a house stuffed with electronics.
I'm a video maniac, and my house is full of video equipment, including a VHS recorder, Beta recorder.
Lincoln's home runs on remote control. With these, he adjusts TV monitors and stereo sound all over the house.
The telephone is also equipped with remote control capabilities so that I can call my home from anywhere in the world and turn on my VCR.
Even the baby in Steve's world has her own TV channel. He can watch her from all over the house. She also has her own VCR. Steve plays educational tapes on it. For his own use, he has 1,000 videotapes. He needs a computer to keep track of it all.
If I had a choice of buying a dinner or a new videotape, I'd probably buy the videotape.
I love thinking that maybe I'm going to run into that girl sometime, you know, the baby that's in that. It's in the area, you know, who grew up. She grew up with the camera. I'm sure she is posting a lot of things. Maybe she's just like her father and has, you know, the Facebook channel with everything public as well. But what I love about that piece is that, you know, you see this early sense of that it's not just the ones doing the recording. It's not Big Brother does not have to record us because we are doing it for him. We're already recording everything and putting it all out there. And the problem is when all of that is aggregated and collected. And that's really what we have Susan here to talk about today. So I want to play this video that we found that is associated with some work you did at the Journal. You want to set this up for us?
Sure. So one of the big topics of the What They Know series was advertising tracking cookies. So little bits of text, really, that get stored on your computer or stored on your browser. And some colleagues of mine made a really fantastic video kind of illustrating and explaining what these are and how they work. And so it just paints a really clear picture of what's going on behind the scenes when you're browsing the internet.
And if you have the WFMU app, you can like open up the Ustream, or if you are just go to the website. We have the video playing on right above the Accu playlist on the homepage, so you can check it out there. But let's watch this.
Imagine you walk into a small town, and in that small town you notice a bookstore. You walk into the store and browse its aisles. You pause and you pick up, say, David McCullough's biography on John Adams. But after mulling it over, you decide you don't have time for books. You leave the store, and from there you walk down Main Street, and this time you notice a video store. You walk in, and one of the first things you see is a poster advertising John Adams, HBO's adaptation of David McCullough's biography. Coincidence? Maybe in the real world, but when you surf the web, seeing advertisements for products that match your personal interests is rarely a coincidence. It's called behavioral targeting, and when it's done from site to site, it's achieved through tracking. Advertisers see it as an effective tool, but some people worry that it's a violation of their privacy. At the center of this debate is what's known as the third-party cookie, a small text file that stores information on your hard drive. That's what allows for this sort of tracking to take place. So how does it work? Well, to understand third-party cookies, we need to understand cookies. To understand cookies, we talk to the cookie creator himself. This is Lou Montulli, probably best known for his early work on the World Wide Web. Before dropping out of college, Lou wrote Lynx, one of the first web browsers, and as one of the founding engineers of Netscape, remember them? He developed what today is an integral part of our everyday experience of the web, the now ubiquitous cookie. Lou tells us why we even needed a cookie in the first place.
So in 1994, we were working on an e-commerce solution for the web. What we wanted to allow was a shopping cart so that users could select products and put them into this shopping cart and select further products and then go through a checkout process. At that time, the web didn't have any concept of memory.
Without memory, if customers placed an item in their cart, it would disappear the moment they visited another site. So to solve this shopping cart problem, Lou created the cookie. First, let's identify the main players. To start, there's you and your computer. And on your computer, you have your browser. Firefox, IE, Chrome, take your pick. Next, you have the website, which delivers the pages that you visit, Amazon, eBay, Google, etc. When you go to a site for the first time, it wants to remember you, so it assigns you an ID number that's contained in a little text file called a cookie. Then, whenever the server sends a web page back to you, it includes the cookie with it. That ID number lets the site remember the pages you visit, the products you store in your shopping cart, and whatever information you've provided, such as your username, your real name, or your billing address. In your computer, the cookie is linked to the name of the site, so that every time you visit it, the site will recognize you. Once the cookie is in place, you can add a toaster to your cart without it ever disappearing. Unless you delete the cookie, the toaster will stay in your cart even if you visit another page or another site. It's like having great customer service at a cafe where the barista remembers your name and your drink. Most people know that a site has access to your browsing history within its own site. It's not surprising when Amazon.com sees that you've looked at David McCullough's John Adams and then recommends another book in the same genre. And a lot of people find it helpful. But it's a little different when you visit a separate site altogether that seems to know about your taste too. Even in the early stages of cookie creation, Lou was concerned about privacy issues.
A fair amount of effort was given to try to keep cookies from being shared between various websites that are not related.
Although limits were built into the cookie at the start, trackers, which are often ad networks, have found ways to work around those limitations, allowing them to follow your movements from site to site. They do this using the third-party cookie. Advertisers also request that websites install cookies on your computer. These are known as third-party cookies because they piggyback off the original site you visited. For example, when you visit a site that has a banner ad, let's call it site number one, your browser is communicating with both site number one and the advertiser. The advertiser, like the original site you visited, is also assigning your computer an ID number using the third-party cookie. This is what sets the stage for behavioral targeting. So how does the third-party cookie allow for behavioral targeting? Let's say you visit another site, site number two, and that site also has a relationship with the same advertiser. When you arrive at the site, the advertiser will check your cookie file and look for its cookie. If the cookie is there, the advertiser will remember you and show you a related ad. It'll also add information saying you visited site number two. Ad networks are companies that do this kind of tracking on hundreds or thousands of sites they do business with. The bigger the ad network, the greater its potential to track your online habits across the web and develop a profile of you. Then, it can show you ads for products you are more likely to buy. A lot of people concerned with privacy probably already know to delete their cookies, but trackers have figured out ways to work around this. Other tracking methods are less noticeable and harder to remove. Some, such as flash cookies, can respawn cookies you've deleted without your even knowing it. As the tracking business becomes a growing part of the online advertising ecosystem, privacy advocates are pushing for more regulation. They want greater transparency and better options for consumers to control what's known about them, so that when you browse the online bookstore and look at that copy of John Adams, you can decide who knows about it. For the Wall Street Journal, this is Christina Sui.
Okay, so if you were following along on the video stream, you were able to see that video. My name is Benjamin Walker. You are listening to WFMU. Our guest for this hour is Susan McGregor, who worked on that series that video was a part of. And I just want to throw out that if you want to leave any comments on the Accu playlist page that we have up, we can get to those. Any questions? Because where we want to end up in this hour is how... what we can do, what are some of the things we can do, why should we do some of the things we do to sort of push back against that wonderful phrase, behavioral targeting, because that's, I guess, coming back to the video streams, really where those two link up, is that when you know you are being watched, your behavior is going to be modified. And when you know now that this is how much they can track you online through your behavior, it is behavior modification. Is that a good way to connect the two there?
Yeah, I think so.
All right, we're going to go with that. Walk us through here some of the, you know, and I think a lot of our listeners here at WFMU are aware somewhat, at least peripherally, ambiently aware of just, you know, how cookies work and how the metadata is aggregated and collected. But walk us through, you know, in terms of, you know, I want to get back to the commercial aspects, but I think there's a few other projects you've worked on about metadata and what it all means.
Sure. So, I mean, if you're on the video feed now, what you're seeing is sort of an illustrated version of what happens on the internet. And so, you know, basically the idea here is just to visualize how information moves around the internet. So I think, you know, the issue is that when we have digital communications, it's not a single system, right? It feels seamless to us. We open up our computer, the wireless, you know, goes on, it connects to our wireless router in the background, and, you know, we're on the web. And in reality, it's actually, these things are sort of many layers of systems. And it's one of the things that makes sort of digital security and protecting your privacy online so complicated is the fact, or apparently complicated, is the fact that it isn't a single system. And so there's kind of different layers that you have to think about. But basically, you know, the issue is that we have, you want to connect securely to anything you're connecting to, whether it's your router, you know, which means don't use unsecured wireless networks, particularly in random locations. And you want to protect your devices. I think it's amazing these days because so many of us have multiple devices. We have these really very expensive mm-hmm. pieces of electronics, but we, you know, we kind of leave them on the table in the coffee shop, and we use the restroom, and we kind of put them, you know, we leave them on the... And the reality is that a lot of digital security is actually physical security. So a lot about protecting your information is just, you know, making sure that you've encrypted your hard drive and have a real password on it, and not leaving your computer out, not using random USB drives that you're given is a big part of, and not downloading things that you don't recognize. A lot of us kind of know that today, but you know, as a colleague of mine says, as far as your computer is concerned, you're God. And so anything that you install or download on your computer can kind of do anything. It can send your information out to the web, and we know that you know, sometimes you actually get USB drives shipped new that have malware on them. And really, it's just kind of this, it is its own kind of dragnet, where the idea is just collect as much information as possible on the mm-hmm. off chance that it will be useful, and the off chance that it can be used, you know, for identity theft or something like that. So yeah, basically, you know, this is just a quick overview. You just always want to use as secure a connection as possible, is pretty much what it comes down to, and physically protect your devices.
So I think you had something you were going to show us related to sort of walking through, looking at what people can see when you visit a website. Is that?
Mm-hmm. So... So I think one of the things that is not necessarily apparent to us when we use the web is that, among other things, one of the pieces of information that is visible to the websites that you visit is actually your, within relative proximity, your physical location. So IP addresses, internet protocol addresses, actually correspond to geographic locations. They are their own kind of map. What we're looking at on the video feed right now is actually, this is data coming off. It happens to be a U.S. government website. And it looks like a whole lot of gibberish, but in there we can find in different, in each entry, there's actually a location. So I'll do a quick highlight here where we can see there's actually a latitude and a longitude that comes with each of these entries. So you can actually look at this and see the geographic location, where in the world people were logging on from, if their login ID is part of it. And this is just an example because this server happens to be set up to show us this information, but actually every web server in the world is noting that. So it doesn't matter if you're logged in or not. Basically, every time you connect to a website, it knows basically where you're coming from and how much time you spend there. All of that is logged, and all of that information is accessible to law enforcement. It is defined as metadata and not considered private. And so if it ever comes to the point where somebody wants to know what you were looking at and when and where from, that's highly, highly accessible.
Yeah. But again, moving that outside of the law enforcement context, it seems that these are the same technologies and the same processes that are being used perhaps to surveil people who are using EBT services or government assistance programs.
Sure. I mean, I think one of the most important things to realize about this, about our sort of newfound awareness of digital surveillance is that, surveillance is as old as history, right? Watching populations that are considered outside the norm or potentially problematic is. You know, really sort of as old as time. And so, one of the things that I think about, I live sort of just south of Harlem, and one of the things I always think about is Stop and Frisk in New York City, right? I mean, we're
story last year.
Yeah, huge ongoing story. The fact that there are countless communities that are used to being surveilled, and surveillance isn't just about, it isn't just about somebody tracking your metadata. And many of the systems that we have in place have been used. I think one of the things is that all of these technologies, at their heart, were designed for another purpose, right? So you take something like EBT, or you take something like the internet, metadata that's being logged on the internet. It wasn't designed for surveillance, but it serves that purpose very, very well. You have to sort of think about why those systems are in place, and you can't be wholesale in your rejection of them because they actually do serve a valid purpose. So how can we create an environment where we can both have and use the services that we need, but without compromising our fundamental rights?
It seems like you could say that maybe the solution is simple, and that the solution is simply just making sure these things are not connected together. And this is something that, they talked about over some of the NSA programs that were revealed through Snowden and through Ryzen, was that there was a version of it that did strip out user information, that anonymized some of the data that they were collecting. Is that perhaps a solution, or is that not in other words, is it possible to imagine there's a technology solution?
So it's actually the interesting thing. So de-anonymization is actually a really difficult thing to do because as soon as you start intersecting data sets, patterns emerge very quickly. There's a scholar, LaTanya Sweeney, who has done work on this for many years. She famously was able to individually identify people. This was sort of before high bandwidth internet was common. And I think she purchased two different CDs of sort of general information, both of which had been quote unquote anonymized. And by putting them together, was able to individually identify people. And this was 15 years ago, and when you were paying $20 for a CD-ROM of data. The issue is, I expect that it is theoretically possible, but it's very difficult to do effectively when you have so many different types of data, so many different lenses on people that can be quite efficiently combined.
But interestingly, though, you would have to say, though, that it is a pattern that you notice. And like, I'm thinking of the talking heads from the Frontline special last week, the good guys in the NSA, the ones that are presented as, I guess, maybe good cop is a better way to say it. But the good cop, bad cop scenarios, the good cops are all saying that, no, there are simple technology solutions that could protect Americans, respect the Constitution, and allow us to surveil the bad guys, look out, keep America safe, and keep American citizens' rights and protect them. I think that like the story you just talked about with the CD-ROMs kind of says that that's not exactly possible.
It's very difficult. I mean, I think what you can do is you can certainly make rules, and in theory that many of those rules are already in place, right? But, you know, can you, I mean, actually an interesting area of research right now is sort of auditing. Can you prove that people are following the rules?
Yeah.
Can you check if people are following the rules? And, you know, obviously that's what the rule of law is about, right? But I am not a statistician, but I suspect it would be very, very difficult to do at scale.
The other day I was in Tompkins Square Park, and there was this it was like two mothers and a father, like, you know, with a lot of kids sitting by the playground, and I overheard their conversation. They were talking about going to the circus and how you can't go to the circus anymore because there are cameras there that are connected. I mean, this was the guy mansplaining a bit to the women with kids, but his theory, what he was saying is that there are cameras now at the circus connected to the IRS that can tell, like, just through surveilling the audience, that there are some people that shouldn't be there because they're on government assistance programs, and then, you know, they can even tell by the price of the ticket area, and then that information is collected and then sent back to other agencies that could act on that information.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, that kind of thing, I mean, operates off of facial recognition, which I think is, you know, one of the issue of biometric information, biometric identifiers, your face, your fingerprints. The idea of how do you protect yourself against that kind of surveillance? And this, you know, this issue goes back 100 years from, you know, the introduction of still cameras. Some very, very famous decision by Justice Brandeis, you know, this issue of people's images being captured on the street. And, you know, the United States is unusual somewhat unusual among Western countries in that you're allowed to take pictures of people in public. If you go to France, it's not legal to take a picture of someone on the street and publish it.
That's why we have better street photography books.
True. But anyhow, I mean, I think it's this idea of how do we protect our information. It isn't just digital, and I think this sort of goes back to this idea of, you know, we recognize that a lot of inappropriate surveillance of communities takes place in ways that they are around things that they are not able to hide. We, you know, unless you're going to wear makeup, you know, crazy makeup to make your face unrecognizable to a camera, you don't have a choice. And so in that environment, you know, you really don't have a choice. It's not just about, oh, I'm going to go off, you know, I could go off, but you could go off the grid. You could not do this. You have to live with your face, and you have to carry it around with you. And so, you know, reflecting on that as a really non-optional way of
but where are we in terms of technology with biometric sensors? And one of the things we had some listeners send in were some images of some sensors that we've been kind of playing on a loop. But, you know, I actually expected, I was hoping maybe you would say, oh, yeah, we're not there for facial recognition stuff yet.
And we
would just say, that's not happening. But, So let's talk about, you know, where before we're going to end up here, and I just want to throw out one more time. My name is Benjamin Walker. You're listening to WFMU. We're doing a special hour here, squatting on Lisberg's show with Susan McGregor, talking about surveillance and security issues. And we're going to end up with the hour talking about what are some of the things we can do as individuals and as citizens. And if you have a question or something you wonder about, drop it into the comments thread and we'll get to it. But let's just, before we go there, let's talk about some of these other sensors. And when you add that information to the information that's already being collected, where's that taking us?
I mean, you know, I have a colleague at Columbia who recently, in collaboration with a lawyer, was doing some work to see how quickly you could deduce, essentially predict a person's location if you looked at GPS data. So if you had the GPS on your phone, how long would law enforcement, or how long would someone need to collect that information to be able to predict your movements? And their preliminary conclusion is about a week. And interestingly, what they discovered, I think this is amazing, is that our movements are actually more predictable on the weekend than they are during the week over time. So, I mean, really, it's getting to that. I mean, it is effectively at that point where it's not just, you know, seeing where you are, but knowing where you will be, knowing what you will be doing, who you will be with. And, you know, that has, I think that has really terrifying implications. Yeah. And I think it really, you know, as we sort of touched on, I think it just, we're aware, you know, in the back of our minds, we're aware of the system and we don't feel at liberty to do and think and say and be who we want to be or choose to be. And there's also that the sort of whole the whole issue of history, right, that we're kind of being followed around by our history in a way that, you know, I think has implications for the way that we develop as well. You know, I mean, if I think back to adolescence, we all try on different identities usually. And now those identities are not only imprinted but broadcast and kind of never go away. And so what does that mean as well?
Yeah. But, you know, and a lot of researchers have talked about this. I mean, I'm thinking even like Dana Boyd talking about youth and Facebook, though. But, you know, as we watch digital natives sort of become, you know, go into their 20s, do you feel that, like, that's true? That, like, some of the things that they've done have actually stuck with them? Now that was sort of the argument, right? That there are things, and I believe that. I actually do believe that everything you say will be used against you. But I'm a firm believer in that one. But do we have evidence to sort of see that the behavior modification is happening?
You know, it's interesting. I actually think that the scholarship, and I mean, Dana Boyd is a wonderful expert on this. You know, and we see this come out in news headlines a bit too. Not surprisingly, you know, the kids are all right, right? Younger generations today, they know exactly what's happening. They know exactly how these systems can be used to watch them, and they're actually, earlier generations. I think it's older, you know, not even older, right? Older than, you know, 20s. That sort of need the education on this front, because, you know, the digital natives, you know, they understand this data is being collected. They switch apps. They have multiple accounts. You know, they know how to game the system. And I think it's sort of an irony of the whole thing. And especially if you think about this as security, you know, and we have to, you know, keep people safe. You know, the problem is that if you put too much faith in the work of that system, you're blind to the people who are subverting it.
Yeah.
Right? In other words, if you rely too much if you put too much faith in the quality of what that information shows you, you're blind to anyone who knows how to get around it. And those people are not, you know, that's not going to be someone who is scared to, you know, it's not going to be somebody asking a question on the internet, you know, and is embarrassed about it, and so they put on private browsing or whatever. You know, it's going to be it's going to be the dangerous people probably who do that. You know, so it's a sort of potential and probable backfiring of the whole thing.
Yeah. So we're going to move on to, I guess, we've only got 15 minutes left. I told you this hour would go fast. we want to end up with talking about some of the things that we can do. But before we go there, I just want to make sure that we've talked about the metadata. And I have to say that what you just simply rolled out with the story about the CD-ROMs is kind of, again, like we hear this time and time again, that the good cop perspective, which is, no, we can safeguard that. We can keep your identity safe. We can take you, and sort of that's what the advertisers promise us too, right? We're talking about, you know, the video that you showed us earlier is that, like, no, we're just collecting this data, but, you know, at the end of the day, no one will know who you are. But then we know that there are these companies that are buying and selling and doing that analysis so they can sell to other advertisers your information plus the supposedly anonymous information together. But I guess, you know, how can we shut that argument down? Again, I just saw this on national television where, you know, we were told that, oh, we can keep people safe. How do we shut that down?
Shut down the argument?
Yeah,
or
offer a rebuttal. Like,
I think the obvious thing is that anytime data can be intersected, it can be, you know, within a couple of steps can be de-anonymized, right? And so, you know, the unless basically unless you make it illegal to buy and sell information, right? Unless you don't let companies actually trade in data. You know,
all I'm hearing is the NRA, sort of like the new version of the, like, if I can't buy and sell data, only the criminal. Yeah, it's terrible. But so our guest today is Susan McGregor, and we're going to move on now towards learning about some of the things that we can do as trying to live in this brave new world. So you have, I think, some more slides.
Oh yes, yeah, sorry. I'm like, I don't
and you can watch along on the WFMU homepage or on the app.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the basic strategies are quite simple, and most of them are things that you that are available to you already. So, I mean, you know, really basic things. Use secured wireless. There is a great plugin from the EFF called HTTPS Everywhere. So when you connect to a website, it's just a little plugin you can install in your browser, and that will give you a secure connection wherever possible to any website you visit. Probably the biggest thing is looking at is your passwords. Right. This is the biggest thing on your accounts. You know, if you have that operation for the option for the two-step auth, where it, you know, also sends a message to your cell phone, do it. The best way to think about it is not passwords, but passphrases. You know, a favorite song lyric is fine. If you have an inside joke with your best friend and it's, you know, a several word phrase, those are great. Those things make great passwords. They're memorable. You know, don't use random USB drives, and you know, keep your things safe, and you know, your actual physical devices in your possession. You know, that's sort of the main thing. You know, if you are concerned, you know, if you want to be able to do something like browse the web anonymously, the Tor browser bundle is a really fantastic tool. You download it and double click it. It works just like a regular browser. You know, what Tor does specifically is that issue of your location being visible. Tor hides your location by sort of sending your traffic, your web traffic, through a little pipe, so that it pops out somewhere else in the world. You know, those are the main things, and you know, you can get sort of more elaborate from there. You can start dealing with things like encryption and all of that, but really just some very basic things about how you connect to the web, and what you do there. You know, how you connect it and how you browse. Really simple things. Doesn't take a minute.
But the key word there is hide. And it seems that one of the things we've learned from the Snowden revelations is that when people do use encryption or do even take steps to hide or protect, mm-hmm. they become more of a target.
Sometimes. I mean, and yet, of course, that is an argument for all of us doing it more. Right?
Yeah.
So the reality is that, you know.
I see where you're going.
Yeah. I mean, it's that, you know, it's. You want to do these things. You want to do these things, not necessarily even because you're trying to quote unquote protect the information that you're using. But basically, we're all better protected. It's a herd protection. The more people who use encryption, yeah. the more people who use these tools, the better off you are. And the same thing goes for using something like Tor, you know, which we know is a necessary option for people in repressive. Regimes worldwide. Everyone who uses Tor, it helps them because it helps their traffic hide in the crowd.
So I'm not a technologist, but I want to run my little idea by
yeah.
you. So it seems to me that maybe, you know, the hiding thing is not, you know, going. You know, one of the things that's impressed me from again those revelations was that just that the government actually will target people, you know, who are using encryption services or Tor, and it seems that maybe a better way, like, can we just invent a program where I can install on my laptop and I go online and it just visits 8 million other websites in the background at the same time, so I'm just like spewing out like tons and tons of data, but where I'm really going would just be sort of hidden in there.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of that. I don't.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes.
I'm ready to accept my award. Does that work?
I mean, in principle, it works. It's the same idea. I'm trying to think technically how one would execute that. But I mean, the idea of sort of piggybacking traffic definitely, you know, is definitely out there. And there are some things where it's not so much that you log on and you're spewing 8 million things, but you can actually let you can install something on your website that lets other people use that website as a portal, as a little Tor node. So you know, it's a similar principle, right? Which is that which is just that idea of creating noise.
Yes,
right?
The noise. We've got a few other things to show here when it comes to noise, and it seems like a lot of artists or digital artists have examined this one, maybe not inventing my plugin. And, you know, if anyone wants to go invent that, go ahead. I mean, I just kind of made that up. I don't know if it would really work. But the noise thing does attract me as a response to, and rather than hiding. It seems to me that, like, the way my view of the world, like, that's probably you're going to have more success.
Sure. I mean, I used to. So one of the projects that I did, which was this, I made, you know, jewelry pieces that hid USB keys.
You're wearing one around your neck now.
This actually is This is an identity. This is an identifier. It's kind of the opposite, but it's similar. It's sort of a complement of that idea. And you know, this came to me because I was doing research in this topic, and I was thinking, you know, when we talk about this stuff, we're always talking about, you know, encryption and technology and all this stuff, and that's all well and good. But, you know, how do regular people, how do we engage this, especially if maybe we don't even use these systems that much? And I just used to say to people, you know, what if we all just walked around with, you know, 12 USB keys with encrypted Hello Kitty cartoons on them? You know, I mean, if we just did that as a matter of course, you know, and to me that's noise, right? We're carrying around a bunch of data, and most of which is useless, and you know, it's not worth searching.
You're not in the Hello Kitty fan club,
yeah,
are you?
It's true.
There are gasping right now.
I was going to say, I'm never going to get in now either. That's the problem. You know, that there are ways to kind of, you know, participate and, you know, create that noise that all of us have access to. And again, you know, on the digital side, doing some of this stuff, using some of these tools like Tor is a way to do that. And, you know, also, frankly, like, you know, when you're asked for information on a website or for a login or whatever, you know, enter as little as possible. I know people who intentionally scramble that, right? And that's also a really simple trick, you know? You don't, you know, just put in as little as you have to, and unless you're legally obligated, you don't even have to put in the right stuff. You know, and so that's another way to sort of introduce noise into the system. Create multiple email addresses, you know? I know somebody who, this is way smarter than I am, who has a separate email account she uses for all, like, you know, promotions that she gets. And it's just that's where
Very
all
smart.
That stuff goes, right? So she doesn't even have to look at it in her inbox. You know, and so it's things like that that you can do as well that introduce that noise into the system, you know? So I think the relationship between hiding and noise is kind of complementary, yeah. You know?
And you, these USB things, you made those as part of a group that you were working with, a group show at iBeam, I think that was it last year?
Yeah, it was last October. Prism Breakup was the show, and a lot of really great work there. But yeah, kind of looking, you know, in various lenses on the themes of surveillance and privacy.
And Adam Harvey participated in that one too?
Yeah, I think so. And his was the work we saw earlier with the anti-facial recognition makeup, and he's done a few things like that, some obscuring
this anti-satellite hoodie.
The anti-satellite hoodie, yeah. And there's another one. The photo is not super illustrative, but something called the attack jacket, which came out from MIT, which is part of their sort of defensive clothing program. And I believe it emits an electric current if someone touches it. If you get grabbed, it will actually shock that person. So, you know, lots of really creative ways to think about this stuff and think about, both hiding and protecting.
Well, one of my favorite things about talking to you is just thinking differently about how to talk about surveillance. And can you talk about this graphic novel that you're working on now? This is a great project.
So I'm working on, it's part of my white paper, actually, but looking working with an illustrator, a fantastic illustrator, Matteo Farinella, who recently came out with his first book. He collaborated called Neurocomic, which debuted in the U.S. a couple months ago. And
I saw it at the Mocha Festival from Nobrow, on the Nobrow table.
You betcha. And really what we're trying to do with that work is illustrate some of the key concepts around digital communications and surveillance. You know, a picture is worth more than 1,000 words in that case. And you know, I think what we're hoping to do is this idea of taking these invisible systems, you know, digital systems that are not visible to us, and making them visible, right? And that lets us talk about them. That just lets us talk about them in the first place. And so, looking forward to having that come out next month.
So I'm kind of a not a very optimistic person when it comes to this. I actually am more on the side that, you know, again, everything will be used against us, and it's going to be very, very ugly once they have all this data at their fingertips. It's not just selling us David McKellar books or David McKellar t-shirts. It's much more about taking away what, you know, how we can be managed and surveilled and herded as a herd. But what about you? Are you optimistic about where we're going as a society, country, when it comes to surveillance?
I mean, I think, you know, I will say that I do reflect on earlier times. You know, I remember, and I've sort of studied this portion of history, you know, this country has gone through some pretty dark times with surveillance before. You know, if you think about the McCarthy era and you know, the Red Scare and all that stuff. You know, there's a time when people were expected to regularly sign loyalty oaths to the United States, and that was not that long ago. And I think, you know, we came through some of that. So I think it's that. I think also, as I said, you know, one of the rules is that if you're looking for a needle in a haystack, the last thing you want to do is make the haystack bigger, which I think is what we're doing right now. What's happening with this data collection. And I think that, you know, we'll start to see, I think, unfortunately, in some cases we have seen, you know, I think with, you know, the Boston bombing, it was kind of this, you know, there were flags there, and you know, there's not time to follow up every potential lead. And so if they're not good ones, you end up missing the stuff that's really serious. And so I think we're going to start to, you know, you'll start to appreciate that this doesn't work the way that we think it's going to, you know. And you know, more data means more people, means more opportunities for breaches. You know, it's too unwieldy. And so I think that as a practical matter, we'll start to see some pullback from this. And as a legal and political matter, I think we're going to start to see much more organized opposition to this.
Well, I am happy to go to that future with you. I want to thank you again for helping us here at WFMU make some of these invisible systems and invisible data collection surveillance systems visible as well. And Susan McGregor, it's been really great having you here. Thanks again.
Thank you so much.
So you are listening to WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. Thanks to Liz Berg and Ken Friedman and Ruth, who helped us with the video feed today. I hope you enjoyed seeing some of those. The whole thing will be archived, and stay tuned. Irene will be on in a few moments.
Across the moon. that's the holler of the werewolf when he's feeling blue. He goes out in the evening when the bats are on the wing, and he's killed some young maid before the birds sing. For the werewolf, for the werewolf, have sympathy, 'cause the werewolf might be some. Thank you.
Buckets of rain fell in Amsterdam, swallowed the soles of my feet. Then you took a train down the south, the promises that